Thompson setting his way on Waiters. And score. Thompson on a pull-up. Oh, hit the rainbow. Westbrook is beat. Rejected by Green. Curry fires one up.
Westbrook just told Durant, go. Let's play quick. Quit playing around.
And Durant able to knock it down. Durant with a long three-pointer. Here's Durant ahead of the field. Goes to the fadeaway and scores. Steph Curry dumps it up to Curry for three. Here comes Curry. He's triple teamed. Continues. He adds off the dribble. Steph Curry off the five.
I think the effort was good. We still can play better, for sure. All of our IQ, all of our gamesmanship. I mean, honestly, we just did what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to win at home. The team that's only lost two games in the regular season and whatnot. So this is a place where we have experienced a lot of winning, and you know, we're supposed to do, you know, to take care of games like tonight. There's no real sense of accomplishment because of that, because we know what we still have to do going forward.
I mean, I think I was better tonight. Still didn't do all the things I'm capable of doing. But the one thing I can control is the way I go out there and fight and battle. That was my mindset tonight. I was coming to a fight. I'm going to go out there and do that. If all else fails, I'm going to fight. And that'll be my mindset for the rest of the series.
We're going back home, but, you know, we can't relax. We got to keep our foot on the gas. You know, we got to play much better. I thought we played extremely hard tonight. They didn't outplay us. They didn't outwork us. Both teams, you know, were in this slugfest tonight. We got to bring that energy back home. It's a matter of us making a few shots and, you know, playing a little more solid defense on them.
We got to take care of home. Honestly, last night is a different game. We just got to, I guess, play the same way we played the two home games we've had so far tomorrow. That's all we could do. I mean, can't worry about the road. Honestly, can't worry about the road. We might not get a chance to go back on the road if we don't play the right way tomorrow.
I mean, obviously, this is it, you know, for them, you know, but we have the same mentality. This is our game seven, and that's how we approach it.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Well, you know, you can't get everything you want every day. And I would like to follow up on that comment, but I was having a real hard time making my microphone work. There wasn't a long dramatic pause there for the purpose of drama. It truly was just a microphone glitch. I was talking and not hearing. You wanted, if you're me, if you're like me, and I think there's a lot of people who agree then with their Western Conference predictions in this Western Conference playoff, NBA playoff run, a lot of people are really, really hoping that the Thunder do indeed finish off the Golden State Warriors. I would love for them to have done it in the O, meaning the Oracle Arena, and the O, meaning the O as in Oakland. That would have been like the best of all worlds. But you know what? You can't get all of those kind of things the way you want them, when you want them. But that doesn't mean that you're not going to get them. Last night, we could have really celebrated something huge with the cocky, punky Golden State Warriors getting punked on their own home court. And knocked out of the playoffs after 73 regular season wins and a championship last year. It would have been nice. It would have been a thing of beauty. But unfortunately, you know, it's a tough place to play. And as great as the Thunder have played in this series, it's just hard to win twice in their building. But the good news is, when you're the Oklahoma City Thunder, you don't have to win twice in their building. All you have to do is don't lose in your own. And win one in their building, and you are in the NBA Finals. And that's where we find ourselves as we head into the Eastern Conference Final, game number six tonight. You have a Thunder team that is still up 3-2, now going back to their home court tomorrow for the closeout, where they have blown out the Warriors, the only two times, of course, they have played in that series in that building. So it would have been something to see last night. There would have been some poetic justice in it if Kevin Durant was able to lead his team to that Western Conference Championship last night in Oakland, especially just as a statement game against the powers that be that vote for the All-NBA teams, that somehow, some way, found Kevin Durant on the second team looking up at DeAndre Jordan and Kawhi Leonard. Please, someone tell me you are joking about that. there were a lot of people, and I was on Twitter last night, kind of rattling cages a little bit and just kind of bumping around about how angry I was that Kevin Durant got screwed out of first-team All-NBA yesterday. And a whole bunch of folks said, watch KD go for 40 tonight, just as a statement, because this is ridiculous. He did exactly that. He had 40 on the button. Took 31 shots. Wasn't his most efficient shooting game, 12 out of 31. But he was perfect. At the line, 13 for 13. He had 7 boards and 4 steals. Just not enough. Neither was Russell Westbrook's 11 out of 28, 31 points. And he had 7 rebounds and 8 assists. Just not enough. Last night at Oakland, or at Golden State, because, again, that's just a very, very tough place to play. But you know what? The good news, if you're the Oklahoma City Thunder, and we're going to spend a lot of time on the NBA, we're going to talk a lot of basketball because in the first hour, because coming up in the second hour, we're going to spend a little bit more time on some baseball issues and on the Baylor football scandal. I've got some thoughts on that that I really feel I need to share with you. So we're going to do that. And not just share with you, but listen to you as well. So I'm really looking forward to that. But for the first hour, we're going to talk a lot of basketball. We will preview the Eastern Conference Final Game 6 tonight up in Toronto at We the North, Cavaliers and the Toronto Raptors going at it yet again. But last night, the good news, if you're the Thunder, is you're still not seeing the Golden State Warriors that won 73 games. You're still not seeing them and thinking, now what do we do? We can't beat those guys. That's just not happening. And because that's not happening, there is no reason for them to feel badly. They didn't get blown out last night on the road the way they blew out Golden State in 2 games at home in Oklahoma City. They just lost. And they lost with Thompson and Curry being very pedestrian, essentially, being very pedestrian in that game. Steph Curry, Klay Thompson combined to make 17 shots out of, now I seem to have lost it. Do you have the box score in front of you, Mr. Cushlin? Because my computer just actually went to sleep on me.
Oh, that's always fun. Yeah, I'm bringing it back up right now.
It's one of those days I'm having things break down all over the place anyway, but my computer is out. So do you have the, I know Curry, I think, was 9 for 20, maybe?
9 of 20, 3 of 8 from downtown.
And that, which is a good percentage for the Thunder. A good percentage,
yes,
when he's only 3 of 8. And Klay Thompson was 8 of 21,
2 of 9 from downtown.
So neither one of the Splash Brothers really were a splashing, and that's the second straight time.
5 of 17 total.
Yeah, for Curry especially, that's the second straight time. Especially, you know, looking back to the blowout in Game 4. Thompson did go off in Game 4 for a stretch. Remember, he scored 19 straight points at one point. My point is, though, nothing, Jim, have you seen anything from the 73-win defending champion Warriors that makes you scared if the Cavaliers face them in the finals?
Not if they're shooting colder, relatively speaking, for them, because this whole series they've been kind of colder. I mean, they had 2-4 blowouts.
Well, is what they are.
Exactly.
I mean, I still think they're as good as people think they are,
including myself, as
we've watched throughout the year. I think there may have been a little bit of overrating being done.
But that happens also when you specifically aren't making shots. And to a degree, especially relative to the percentages they can throw out there, they have not been hitting shots at their regular pace overall in this series. Curry's had low numbers, as you talked about. I think one of the blowout losses in OKC, he didn't even crack 20 total points.
I think we'd be erring, though, if we simplified it to them making shots.
I think it's a big part of it.
It is, but I think that's an oversimplification. The defense that the Thunder have played on them is one of the reasons they're not making shots. It's not like
they're also
they're
getting
just
Green
cold
out of his rhythm. And you've heard me argue, Bob, that you got Curry and what he can do, and the Splash Brothers as a duo. But in some ways, he's not the straw that stirs the drink, but he's part of what really makes that old team go is Green. And we've noted the ridiculous minus number he had in those 2 games in Oklahoma
City. -73,
which is just absurd. He was a little bit better with 11 and 13 and 4 assists and 4 blocks yesterday. He was a little bit better, and so that's part of why they're there. I mean, this is also Warriors team that, blowout or not, has been held under 20 points 2 fourth quarters over the course of this series. So it's a few things. It's getting Green out of whack. It's they're not making as many shots as they're accustomed to, and Oklahoma City's playing outstanding defense, and they're getting especially if you consider relative to this Cavs-Raptor series, they're getting much, much more consistent production from Durant and Westbrook than, say, the Raptors are getting from Lowry and DeRozan. Yeah. Just trying to compare teams that are really only two big guys instead of a bigger three or something.
Yeah, no, I get that, and I think that's fair. I just I don't like the notion, and I said this to Sam a little bit yesterday, to Sam Amico. I don't like the suggestion that, hey, the Warriors have gone cold. Ergo, it's up to them to win. It's up to them. If they get their shot back, if they start shooting better, there's nothing Oklahoma City can do. Golden State wins. As if it wasn't the Golden State defense that was, as you talked about, Green, taking him out of his rhythm and all the other things. And the way they have run at Steph Curry, making him play defense. The way they have run at Steph Curry defensively.
Yes.
With different guys, long guys, short guys, quick guys. I think their shooting percentage is low, particularly their three-point splashing, as they like to call it, is lower than it has been because of Oklahoma City. I don't want to dismiss that and say that it's just the Warriors shooting bad, and if they get hot, well, then, you know, there's nothing the other team can do to stop them. Secondly, I think Oklahoma City is obviously a very, very, very good offensive team, and they can get shots pretty much whenever they want them.
In the loss yesterday, they shot better percentage and more misses and makes from beyond the arc than the Warriors did.
They most certainly did. That's kind of what I'm talking about. You know, so this thing is not over by any stretch. But Oklahoma City just has to do what they did in the other two. They don't have to blow them out by 20 or 25 like they did in the first two games in their building, games 3 and 4. But they just have to beat them at home.
Yep.
And I really can see that happening very, very, I won't say easily, in the regard that it'll be easy to do, but I can easily see it, you know, happening, you know, with relative.
Well, if you're OKC, that's what it means to go up 3-1, as prior, of course, to yesterday's game, because it puts you in the driver's seat for minimum two games. They're only not in the driver's seat, I think, if it's tied at 3 going back to Oakland. But that gives them two games, one of which is at home, to wrap the thing up. They're still in the driver's seat.
But I mean, honestly, they are only in the driver's seat for now. That's it.
For
this game.
Yes.
I mean, that's it. I mean, if they lose game 6 at home, they're done. They're not going back to Oakland and beating them in game 7.
I tend to agree. They got their one road win, which is what you have to do when you go up against a team like this and you don't have home court. You got to find a way to get one. They still got that one in game 1. That's part of the reason we're here right now.
Exactly right. So I think it's important that we point that out, that this is the must-win game for both teams. I mean, obviously, if Golden State doesn't win it, their season's over.
They're a must-win for 3 straight, no matter how you look at it.
If Oklahoma City doesn't win it, they just handed momentum, 2 straight wins plus a road win to Golden State.
I agree.
As they head back home, and I think it's over then. So their window of opportunity is now. The good news, as I said, there is nothing that I saw in yesterday's game that made me think, oh my gosh, now Golden State is exerting its authority and they're so much better. It was a game. That was it. It wasn't a blowout. It wasn't a nail biter. It was just a game. And they scored a few more. But when the Thunder have beaten the Warriors, they have beaten the dog blank out of the Warriors, especially in their building. And that's why I think going into Game 6 tomorrow. It is tomorrow, is it not?
Game 6 for the Warriors and Thunder is indeed tomorrow. We'll have it for you, 8 o'clock, the pregame time. If there is a Game 7, that's on Memorial Day evening Monday.
Stop. That's not happening. We already decided that. So, but no, in all seriousness, I really think it looks good. Now, let's go ahead and move forward to tonight. And we will, in about 15 minutes, talk to John Godis from RaptorsHQ.com, a part of SB Nation, the official Raptors SB Nation site, in fact, and kind of get their thought on things. If I'm a Raptors fan, or if I'm John Godis or somebody else who is supporting them, I have a very, very different take on what I just described here, because when they just lost to the Cavaliers 2 nights ago, it was an embarrassment. It was a 40-point blowout. I think the fourth quarter started with the Cavaliers up 40, and it ended with the Cavaliers up 38. So they are in a different place, but also for the Cavaliers, they are in a different place physically. I mean, and that is in Toronto, where they are minus 21 in the two games up there. What do they have to do to take the plus 88 that they are at home onto the road into the Air Canada Center and overcome minus 21? I don't want, in the same way, I don't want Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook and the Thunder to have to go back to Golden State and win a Game 7. I don't want the Cavaliers to have to come home and win a Game 7. Do I think they would lose? No, I don't. Not based on the plus 88. I think they would take them down, the Raptors, in a Game 7. But it's not something that they should have to do. It's not something they should want to do. The Raptors are not on their level, which is very, very different than the West, where the Thunder, I believe, are every bit as good as the Warriors. And maybe we are finding out a little bit better. That is not the case in the East. The Thunder are the lower seed, but I think if you look at them man for man, roster for roster, coach for coach, leader for leader, and all the rest, I do not see a talent gap there that says Golden State is better than and the underdog is really, really pulling off an upset here. I see a team that might even be better than they are, and that's why they just want to get this thing closed out now so they don't go back home, or I'm sorry, on the road, and Golden State doesn't go back home where they have all of the momentum in the world to end this thing. So the NBA Finals, obviously, or NBA Conference Finals, I should say, obviously remaining a hot topic of discussion. We want to get you involved in that discussion when you are ready at 866-240-1065. Cavaliers, close it out tonight? Or do you think they again struggle north of the border where the metric system clearly has the different size balls and the different size rims and the different length of the court and the different width of the court, length from the free throw line? All those things are different up there in Canada because it's a metric system, right? I'm joking, of course. I can already see somebody tweeting to me and saying, they don't have anything different. But the way the Cavaliers play up there, something seems different, especially Kevin Love. Do they close it out tonight, or do they go up there and struggle where the metric system conversion rate is a little bit too tough for them to figure out and have to play in a Game 7? What is your call right now? How do you see it shaking out? 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. Hey, don't forget, follow us on Twitter. You can leave your comments there, too, at Sports Radio 1065, at Sports Radio 1065, and on Facebook, at 1065 The Ticket, facebook.com/1065 The Ticket. We would love to get your thoughts on the radio, whether you can wait on hold or not. Jim, I got into a very interesting Twitter war with some knucklehead fanboy in Houston who is furious that the NBA's all NBA teams were announced yesterday, first and second team and third team, and we all know who the first team was. Steph Curry, the MVP, obviously. Russell Westbrook, who finished fourth in the MVP balloting. LeBron James, who finished second in the balloting.
Right.
DeAndre Jordan, surprising to some as the center or big man, if you will, from the Clips. And, of course, Kawhi Leonard, the Defensive Player of the Year and rising star for the Spurs.
Mm-hmm.
That was your first team.
Right.
James Harden, this fanboy from Houston, is just livid that James Harden, who averaged 29 and 7.5 assists and I think 5 rebounds and maybe 2 steals, didn't make first team, didn't make second team, didn't even make third team. And this guy was livid. He's using all the analytics and all of the young fanboy stats, none of which can cover the fact, none of the which that can account for the fact that James Harden doesn't play defense. James Harden should be called James Harren because there is no D, none, when you're talking about this guy. James Harren is a ball hog. James Harren is a one-dimensional player. And James Harren, quite frankly, is not a leader that anybody can rally behind. He froze out Dwight Howard for most of the season, taking control of the ball and doing just his thing with it. His teammates don't respect him. And none of that stuff can be measured in any analytical formula. So James Harden not being on the All-NBA team, first, second, or third team, has got some folks riled up. And the one guy that clearly has to be the most riled up about the NBA's All-NBA teams is Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis of the Pelicans is or was the biggest loser in this entire affair as the NBA announced those all-star teams. And I say that not as in a disrespectful way, calling him a loser. I mean, he literally is the biggest loser in terms of dollars, because Anthony Davis could have cashed up to a $25 million bonus for being named All-NBA. But being snubbed on 1, 2, and 3 team levels of the All-NBA cost him $25 million dollars.
Yeah, I read about that, and that's just a mind-boggling how much money he lost by not being on one of these NBA All-NBA teams. For him, though, rightly or wrongly, the explanation that you'll get from why he didn't make it is his time he spent injured this year. Okay, whatever. As for James Harden, you know, I'm looking over the three teams right now, specifically the backcourt, because here's the gag. You know, you mentioned DeMarcus Cousins is, or if you didn't, he's one of the big men on the second team. By the way, kudos to the Pistons' Andre Drummond. He made the big man is on the third team. Yeah. Unlike, say, the All-Star game now, there still is a space for a big man. James Harden is not in there because you can only take a maximum for these three teams of six guys from the backcourt. And probably because of the defense you speak of and the fact that there was all that really bad vibe kind of drama with him and Howard in Houston this year, those two reasons to me are why he didn't make it. And I can understand how specifically analytics type guys are blowing a gasket over this one because he, you know, he did average high 20s, was third in the league in scoring. I get that. But it's for the Rockets drama and not very good season and the fact that he doesn't play any D. That's why he's the seventh guard instead of in this top six.
Well, I'm going to bring up two things. One, for James Harden, the dude got two coaches fired. Okay? Bottom line.
Yeah, I guess you could say that, yeah.
He did. Bottom line, his inability to get along with Dwight Howard and to get the most out of him and to use him and not just be the one-dimensional scoring gunner that he is. And not basically being coachable for Kevin McHale. I mean, the guy got two coaches fired. Nobody can really control him. He does his own thing. That to me is not anybody that I would ever put on an all-NBA team. All right. So let's just get that out of the way first. He's a bit of a team cancer. He's a great player, but there's a reason he wanted to leave Oklahoma City when he could have been part of a big three there and was. That, you know, contended for championships annually, but he didn't like being the third dog behind Durant and Westbrook. He wanted his own situation. Well, he's got it. And your team is terrible, and you shoot too much, and you're not first, second, or third team all NBA. And when I look at the guards, I see Kyle Lowry and I see Klay Thompson, two third team guys, both of whom were hugely responsible for their teams being in conference finals. I know that this is a regular season award, but there's a reason their teams are in the conference finals now. It's because of how well they played in the regular season.
And you could see they're at least huge. Lowry's deserving of his spot on the third team from even a Cavs perspective. Just think of what he did in games 3 of 4. Those are the reasons why he got this.
No doubt about it. And then if you look at the second team, the one argument some people might make for Harden is over Damian Lillard.
Which I totally disagree with, and I know that that's where they try to go, and I disagree with that profusely.
They do, because Lillard's numbers are a little off. He scores 4 points a game less, 29 to 25. He averaged about a little under an assist less, 7.5 to 6.8, and about a rebound and a half less. But Lillard's team also made the playoffs, won a playoff series, and again, we know these votes come in before the end of the regular season, but the point being his value is pretty clear there. And then Chris Paul, and then of course we know that there's no way James Harden's getting anywhere near Steph Curry or Russell Westbrook on the first team. So what is your argument against the Lillard argument?
Because he plays a little bit better D than James Harden. I mean, but then again, everybody does. I think he's even more valuable to his, you know, to his team. We saw how good that Blazers backcourt is. It's something, you know, that they can absolutely and will be building around. And given what they did this year, they're clearly ahead of schedule on it. He is an absolutely solid, very, very young player. And I have no problem with him getting that nod, you know, over Harden. Well, in fact, the numbers with Lillard is, should he be as high as second team? That, to me, is the only debate on him.
Maybe so. That there might be an argument there. But with respect to Mr. Harden and to the fanboys down there in Houston who are just furious over this whole thing, I'm sorry. Damian Lillard does play defense, and Damian Lillard is also a leader whose teammates respect him. Harden is neither. The way he selfishly froze out Howard for pretty much the entire season to get his. Remember, this is a guy who spent the entire off season last year, this last off season, barking about what? barking about how he should have won the MVP over Steph.
Yep.
That he was better than Steph Curry, and he was throwing numbers out and this and that and the other thing. So this is just apparently what they do down in Houston when it comes to James Harden. Everybody cries and gripes and whines and complains rather than actually just doing something to earn what you want to be, what you want to get. And that includes playing defense. But I do want to say one thing, and I'm going to do some of that griping and whining and crying right now. I don't necessarily think there should be positions on the All-NBA teams. And I know traditionally that's what they have done, and that's why you'll have, you know, Bill Russell and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Patrick Ewing, Hakeem Olajuwon, blah, 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 centers. Because and every year you see two guards and a center on the All-NBA teams. I get it. Understand it. Traditionally, makes sense. I just feel like they need to get away from the best at a position as the league has evolved and morphed away from something that has defined positions.
I completely agree with this.
DeAndre Jordan won, you know, he was named starting center.
Right.
He had the by far the fewest votes, by the way, 317 total votes. Everybody else is over 500 and 600. But DeAndre Jordan, I'm sorry, is not one of the five best players in the NBA. And now, because they had to do it by position, even though positions are so impactful and non-consistent, if you will. I know the word would be inconsistent, but I'm trying to make a point. Because nobody plays the game that way anymore. You know, forwards play guard, play point guard. LeBron James plays as much point guard as, Steph Curry and Russell Westbrook do sometimes.
Heck, anybody who's been down to the queue will tell you during intros, he claims position is all positions.
Yeah, exactly right. That's exactly right.
And no, that didn't happen 25 years ago.
No,
it just didn't.
And so we have DeAndre Jordan being named one of the five best players in the NBA, and for some reason Kevin Durant, who is clearly one of the three best players in the NBA, sits there at number on the second team behind Jordan, who doesn't deserve it. But I'm going to go one step further. This is a position for position match here. Kevin Durant and Kawhi Leonard. Somebody in the NBA is going to have to explain to me how Kawhi Leonard. Now this is where I have to be very careful. I'm not trying to be inconsistent or hypocritical, because I just got done saying defense matters when it comes to James Harden not making one of the top three teams in the NBA. I'm not saying defense doesn't matter in this case to prove the reverse point. I'm saying that I know Kawhi Leonard is the second straight year he was the defensive player of the year. I know he is a rising star and a leader on a team that won 67 games. But to say that he is anywhere near the all-around player and threat, especially at closing time, that Kevin Durant is and has been, is a smack in the face of KD Trey. I'm just going to say it point blank. Kevin Durant is a much better player, and if you think that Kawhi Leonard is a much better defender, let's go back and watch that playoff series. Kevin Durant shut down Kawhi Leonard, and when he got switched on guards, he's doing it now in the conference finals against the Warriors. He'll be guarding Draymond Green one play. He'll be guarding Andre Iguodala another. He'll be guarding Steph Curry another. And his 6'11 height, along with his guard-type feet and his 7'4" wingspan, make him a nightmare for guys to try to go around and score. Is he the defensive player of the year that Leonard is? No. Is he some sort of defensive hack the way James Harden is? No. So when you are Kevin Durant and your stats are what they are offensively and your defense is as solid as it is defensively, although not on the level of Kawhi Leonard, clearly Kawhi Leonard is not on the level of Kevin Durant when it comes to offense. So I think that is an embarrassment. Kawhi Leonard averaged 21.2 points, 6.8 rebounds, and 2.6 assists per game this season. Kevin Durant, 28.2, 5.0 assists, 8.2 rebounds, all well above Kawhi Leonard, and a very solid, and when he needs to be, terrific defense. Kevin Durant, again, proving to be one of the more underrated superstars in this game who doesn't get his just due, and that is to be named up there with LeBron James and Steph Curry and his teammate Russell Westbrook as one of the top three or four best players in the NBA.
Yeah, I agree.
It's criminal that he's not getting that love, and that's one of the reasons, Jim, I want to see him in the finals and why I've said on the record that if my Cavaliers can't win the NBA title, the only slight consolation for me would be Kevin Durant winning his first, because he deserves it. He gets no respect in this league.
Yeah.
Not enough, anyway.
And I agree. You know, I would have no problem if you basically swapped Durant and Leonard on these two teams. And, you know, I'm glad you pointed that out. This is like I said, when you ask, am I okay with Harden being where he is? What was the first thing I said? Well, you know, they do keep track of centers, and there's no guard positions left. I agree with that. The All-Star game itself has already done it. Three front court, two back court. They don't even specify positions. All NBA team awards need to adopt this soon. Because then you at least wouldn't have Harden complaining. He'd probably get a squeak onto the third team, and we wouldn't hear all of Houston griping.
It doesn't have to be three front court or two back court either. To me, for the All-NBA team, five best players, period. That's it. Pick the best players in the league. Voters, give a first place vote, second place vote, blah, blah, blah. Five best players in the league.
Yeah.
That's it. That's your all-NBA team.
Yeah, I think in that scenario, Houston wouldn't have to be griping today because he would have squeaked on the third team and, whatever.
And you know what? It's not
because I hate to say this. DeMarcus Cousins, if there's not a specific center position, isn't there. And I hate to say it, Pistons fans, I question if Drummond would be there if there wasn't a specific center position.
He probably would not be, although I have no problem with him being there.
Because you're going to keep the position. He's one of the best three big men.
Well,
yes.
But aside from that, the position thing, the NBA's leading rebounder ought to have a place, in my view, on one of the three
Good
teams.
Good call. Agree 100%
that.
Is a
big, big deal. And Andre Drummond earned that. That's man's work he does down there every night, and he deserves that. So I have no problem with Andre Drummond being on that third team, whether it's by position or not. That is something that makes him one of the 15 best players in the NBA to be named on this team, and that's how I do that. All right, we're late. Let's get out. We're going to talk to John Gotis of Raptors HQ, previewing Game 6 of the NBA's Eastern Conference Finals tonight. Cavaliers and Raptors, do the Cavs close it out and head back to the finals, or do we got to wait two more days and then finger cross over another Game 7, this time in Cleveland? All of that coming up right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket.
Now back to the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
It is indeed an extravaganza each and every afternoon when we are here together. Thanks so much for being a part of it. It's going to be a party in Toronto tonight. The question is will the hometown Raptors be celebrating the evening of their series as they head back to Cleveland, which is a house of horrors for them, by the way, for a Game 7? Or will the Cavaliers be throwing an Eastern Conference championship party in the visiting locker room on their way back to a second consecutive NBA Finals? Joining us now for a little preview, our friend that we have come to know and respect and really enjoy visiting with from Toronto, John Gotis, is with RaptorsHQ.com, which is the Raptors' official site, as a part of SB Nation. And, John, good to talk to you again. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Appreciate you spending the time with us. First of all, wounds have to be licked, I think is maybe the best way to say this, by the Raptors before they come back out and take the court tonight against the Cavaliers. We've seen a lot of blowouts in these playoffs thus far, not just in this series, obviously. In fact, Mike and Mike had a stat after the blowout Tuesday night, Wednesday night, on the air yesterday, that this particular playoff from the beginning round to now has the largest margin of victory of any playoff since they started tracking that stat, and that's because of the number of blowouts that there have been. But I don't think any game in any series was as one-sided and lopsided as Game 5 was back there in Cleveland after Toronto took momentum with their two wins at home. So, very simply, what in the world happened to the Raptors on Wednesday night?
Yeah, it was an unfortunate night for the Raptors. They basically got smacked from the opening tap. I mean, Kevin Love got going early for the Cavaliers. I think that really sparked them. The Raptors just didn't show a lot of resolve, and we saw that in the previous series, Game 6 against Miami. They came out and got beat pretty cleanly. Not as cleanly as this, but the team just tends to come out slow in these road games, which has been a problem all playoffs long, basically, for this team. So it was unfortunate, but better things are on the way, I think, for tonight.
When you say come out slow, it indicates they played better in the second or the third or the fourth. In that particular game, it just didn't. I mean, it was a 31-point halftime deficit. It was 40 going into the fourth quarter. It ended up at 38. I mean, it's, you know, here's the bottom line, John, and I'm trying to figure this out. In the three games in Cleveland of this series, the Cavaliers are a plus 88. Is they won by 50 in the first two combined and now 38 in the last one. And in the two games in Toronto, it's Toronto with a plus 21. It is such a disparity. This isn't really as much of a Raptors question as a general question. How can just the venue, the location, the fans, how can that make such a difference in scores of games between the same two teams playing with the same size ball on the same size court in both arenas?
Yeah, I really don't know any more than you do on that one. It's baffled, I think, everybody watching this series, seeing both teams conquer their home courts like this. I think in game five, you got the perfect storm for the Cavaliers. They were playing with more energy, but they were playing more efficiently, too. Like I said, Kevin Love got going, but it wasn't just him. I think Tristan Thompson won the matchup with Bismack Biyombo down in the paint. I think they were winning in the backcourt, too. Kyrie Irving had a great game, and the Raptors just kind of fell flat in all regards. I'm not sure why the home venue has been such a big deal in this series, but it has me feeling a little bit better about tonight. But, yeah, it's baffled everybody, I think.
Have the Raptors said anything? I mean, the media up there, and I know you're in Winnipeg, but have the, you know, I haven't heard much from Lowry or from DeMar, because obviously they're the two keys. In games three and four, they couldn't miss. Their combined shooting percentage was off the charts, especially in game four. And then, you know, in all three games, Lowry has been horrible in Cleveland, all three of them, and DeRozan not very much better. So, I mean, have they tried to put their finger on what the difference is?
Yeah, surprisingly, they both seem pretty loose today from what I could see. The comments that they gave to media, they were kind of having fun, joking around. They seem to have put whatever happened in Cleveland behind them. But Cleveland's strategy was a whole lot different. In that game five, they trapped both Lowry and DeRozan. The second they got the ball into the front court, I thought that kind of bamboozled them a little bit. They were trying to outlet the ball to guys who aren't ready to catch the ball in specific areas, like Biyombo. He was catching it out of range, and then the Cavaliers would just collapse. I think there's just going to need to be an adjustment to that strategy for the Raptors. They're going to have to find a way to get other players getting to pass the ball, because the Cavaliers look like they've taken a quite... You know, they're really trying to take Lowry and DeRozan out of the game, and they did it in Game 5.
Hey, John, Jim Cushlett here. And, you know, I'm thinking about this, and, you know, it's hard when you to figure out what exactly adjustments, you know, could be made when kind of what we're talking about is psychology. But here's definitely a big one for you. He finally gets back onto the court for the first time in weeks in that Game 5 off the bench. Is one of the possible adjustments we may see is Jonas Valanciunas returning to his normal spot, which is the starting big man in Biyombo on the bench. Give me your thoughts on if that's going to happen tonight.
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of alluding to that by pointing out that the Raptors are trying to pass to Biyombo. I think Valanciunas would be a whole lot better as a guy to be your kind of outlet guy when Lowry and DeRozan are getting trapped, because you can pass around the trap, get it to Valanciunas, and he's shown the ability to either shoot the ball from the top of the key. He's been making that pretty consistently in the playoffs, but he can also take the ball and create for himself, too. He's just a whole lot better of an option, I think, if the Cavaliers are going to continue to trap Lowry and DeRozan. Biyombo's been tremendous in the pick and roll, but if the Cavaliers have changed their strategy to that degree, I think you'll probably see Valanciunas get the start tonight, and he might play more minutes than Biyombo does.
Yeah, it is really interesting. We talked about that a little bit prior to Game 4, Jim, if you recall, and somebody called and asked, you know, how much do you think they'll use Valanciunas, especially with Biyombo playing so well, and my argument was, if you see the Cavaliers go up early, you're going to see more of Valanciunas, because they need offense, and he's a much better offensive player. But if Toronto goes up and they need to hold, and that's the job, then they're going to stick with the defensive-minded Biyombo. But now, I mean, really, it's kind of the same thing, I guess. It's just which Cavaliers team comes out here at the Air Canada Center. If they come out hot shooting again, they've got to give more minutes to the start and more minutes to Valanciunas, because they got to match him point for point. There's no interior defender that's going to stop this team from scoring when they get that hot.
Oh, and we've been saying it all series, too. I think no matter what the Raptors do as far as adjustments, no matter who plays in their rotation, if the Cavaliers' big three are making shots, if those guys on the perimeter who get the ball, like J.R. Smith, if he's making shots, there's nothing you can do to guard the Cavaliers' team if you're the Raptors. There's just such a talent disparity. I think the Raptors have won games specifically when Kevin Love and Kyrie Irving have had their poorest games of the series. So yeah. If those guys are really, you know, if they're going to come out and play their best brand of basketball, there's nothing the Raptors can do.
Yeah, I think that's very true. The talent disparity is huge, and when the Cavaliers are playing to their talent level, you're right. There's really not much for the Raptors to do. It's just a matter of whether or not they come out that hot or not. Let me ask you this from the fan standpoint there. I mean, obviously they have to feel like they make a difference considering the way things have happened there. Is that enough to throw a shooter like Kevin Love off? He seems, because we've all been trying to figure out why it is they're shooting the way they are. Kevin Love, among others, seems to be more mentally fragile, a guy who, when he gets hot, he feels great, and you see what he did in Game 5. But when he starts off slowly, people start to ride him. He starts to feel the eyes upon him. He might start to feel the glare of his own teammates. And if he starts out cold up there, it's over. It's over for Kevin Love, and the fans up there are not going to even let him breathe because, you know, they've seen what a huge difference it is when he's on versus when he's off.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Cavaliers getting him the ball early, getting him comfortable in Game 5 was a huge difference in that game. I don't think he missed a shot the first 8 times he put it up.
Correct.
So that was tremendous for him. The Raptors, when they've been successful in getting him off the floor, it's been exposing him on the defensive end. The trap defense kind of changes that a little bit because it allows LeBron to play a little bit more free safety. And when he's able to do that, it gives the Cavaliers a whole new look on defense. If the Raptors can get Kevin Love in the pick and roll and Lowry and DeRozan have the patience and the wherewithal to work that, I think they can get Kevin Love off the floor like they did in games 3 and 4. But that's going to be a pivotal thing because, like I said, when Love and Kyrie Irving are making shots like they did in game 5, there's really not much the Raptors can do. They've got to kind of expose those guys in order to, you know, get them off the floor and get that advantage.
John Godis is our guest. He is with RaptorsHQ.com, a part of SB Nation. Okay, so you said you feel good now that they're back home, I guess simply because the home team has won every game in this series and in the regular season between these two teams. Are you predicting a Game 6 Toronto win tonight?
You know what? I think the Cavaliers actually win this tonight, but I would expect it to be a very competitive game. I really don't expect this to be another blowout in the fashion of Game 5 or even to the fashion of Games 1 and 2. But if if I leave my shoes here of a Raptors fan and look at this from a Cavaliers perspective, I think you just kind of want to get the job done tonight. They had all sorts of success in Game 5. They basically ripped apart the Raptors' playbook, and I just don't know how the Raptors get back to the Games 3 and 4 when the Cavaliers have adjusted so well in that one game. So I think it'll be close. I think the Raptors fans have really pushed this team, but I think the Cavaliers actually finish it tonight.
Now, I do have one quick off-the-wall question for you, John, kind of related to this, especially if you're predicting the Cavs win, so that would make the Raptors season over. I like to do this every now and again, especially when you get in a weird long playoff series like this. Sometimes I look for weird things. Decided to look up the Raptors going forward, and I got to say, and Bob, you can attest this, especially with the Cavs and all the luxury taxes they're paying. I'm seeing a Raptors team that is in a very enviable position. Even if this is the end of the season for Toronto tonight, you're bringing Carroll, Lowry, Joseph Patterson, Valanciunas all back. Player options on DeRozan and Biombo. And oh, by the way, if everybody who can come back comes back, there's 4 open roster spots and nearly $20 million in what will be cap space since this summer it's going to blow up. The point I'm trying to make is, barring some seismic shift, you know, LeBron leaves Cleveland or Durant goes to Washington or some one of those kind of things, this is shaping up that this could be a Raptors team that if you're the Cavs, for example, we could be right back in this round next year and the year after. I'm really liking the possibility of Toronto maybe being one of, if not the biggest challenger to the Cavs these next couple seasons, just based on what I'm seeing. So even if it ends tonight for the Raptors,
well,
it's not
really
yet.
Before you go on with all of that, and that's a whole lot of praise and a whole lot of what-ifs, though, what do you think, Jim and John, I guess we'll turn it to John with your question there, Jim. mean, what are the chances that DeMar DeRozan re-signs there? This guy's going to get paid. And I wonder if he wants to play south of the border and get to a big American city. What are you thinking?
Well, first off, Masai Ujiri has done a masterful job, like you said, just setting this team up for the present and the future. I think, first off, that Bismack Biyombo and DeMar DeRozan are almost guaranteed to deny their player options. I think that would be ludicrous of both of them at this point to take that kind of pay cut to stay with one team, especially when you consider all the money that's going to be thrown around this offseason by every team. DeMar DeRozan then is in a situation where he's going to be a max contract player, which right now looks like it's going to be in the $25, $26 million a year range. I actually expect at this point that he will re-sign in Toronto. I think his friendship with Kyle Lowry has really blossomed this year. I think those two guys understand that this is their team for at least the next 3 years if they both come back. And like Jim said, even if Biyombo leaves, I think if DeRozan comes back, Biyombo is certainly gone for greener pastures, but they still have some flexibility. They still have a really solid roster, and they've got four or five guys at the end of the bench who have just been taking up roster spots all season for this team, which has been frustrating at times, but these are guys who in 2 years are going to be really serviceable rotation players for the Raptors, so they've built the team really nicely for the long term as well. I think just the scenario of keeping this core together, they've made it this far into the Eastern Conference Finals. That's been tremendous. I think you really have to ride this and see how far it can go.
I got to tell you, you may know these guys better. I'm just looking at it as an outsider. I think if I'm right, DeMar DeRozan is from L.A. I mean, isn't he from like the mean streets of Compton or something? The Lakers are, you know, with Kobe leaving, and obviously they got a young core there. They would max him out in a heartbeat, I think, there, and build around him a little bit, I think. You know, as the two guard, as Kobe finally exits and opens space for somebody else, you know, they got a rookie point guard who had his struggles there with their little, personality issue as he took the pictures or whatever the heck happened. But you know what? I can see him wanting to play at home. He wants to play at his home all the way up across the country and into another country. If he can get max dollars from the Lakers, how would DeMar DeRozan not go there to play? New coach, new attitude, new everything there.
Yeah, but it's new and you don't know what's going to happen. I think the Lakers are flush with money, but the NBA rules say that if DeRozan gets the max contract from the team he's already at, he actually gets an extra year's worth of money guaranteed. That's 5 years on a contract worth $26 million a year. That's 1 year where he's, I think, 32, 33 years old. I think that at this point in his career, how do you not take that extra year? And with the Lakers, you just don't know what they're going to be. I mean, there's so many question marks with that team. They're still 2 or 3 years away, I think, from being competitive in a playoff team. I think DeRozan has really taken to Toronto. Like I said, he's taken to Kyle Lowry. He's taken to being a leader of a playoff team the last 3 years. I just don't see how you turn that away for less money to go to a really poor team, to be honest, in the Los Angeles Lakers.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the poor team part, but I also understand being, being in your hometown, playing in front of the fans and around the people in a city that you've obviously grown up in and known to love, and grown to love, I should say. And it is a team that is going to rebound. It is the Lakers. They're not going to stay where they are. And to be at the center of that resurgence, I think would be really, really something to see. But you know what? There were a lot of ifs there that Jim laid out for the Raptors to build something and be good for a sustained period of time.
I'm just saying, if nothing else, I looked at it, guys, and I see the potential in a way that, say, the Hawks don't have, for example. They just have that potential, especially if, John, if they're able to re-sign DeRozan, that's a whole mostly core of a 56-win team that'd be coming back.
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly right.
And you know what? They already have two things the Hawks don't have, and that's Lowry and DeRozan if they were to stay, because the two of them are better than anything the Hawks have. And that's not trying to be disrespectful to a team that had a couple of all-stars, but it just is what it is. They are better. They are on that level. They're not Durant and Westbrook level as a duo. They're not Curry and Thompson as a duo. They're not LeBron and Kyrie as a duo. But they're right there in that next tier, and that's something Atlanta does not have. So certainly that would be the best-case scenario for the Raptors. John Godis of Raptors HQ says the Cavaliers will close it out tonight, not in a blowout fashion the way they have in the other three wins in this series, but that they will close it out up north of the border and head back to the NBA Finals for the second straight year. John, from your mouth to the court tonight, I hope that's exactly what happens. I appreciate your analysis. Always fair and always fun talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a great night. We're going to have a great night watching the Cavaliers win, I hope. We have another great hour of radio to come, though, and we're going to shift gears and get away from the NBA Conference Finals. We're going to talk about Baylor, and we're going to talk about what college football is doing to the culture of the United States of America. I know that sounds melodramatic, and it might sound hyperbolic, but I think it's legitimate, and I'll explain and get your thoughts on it as we continue right here on ESPN.
Thompson setting his way on Waiters. Thompson on a pull-up. Oh, hit the rainbow. Westbrook is deep. Rejected by Green. Curry fires one off. Westbrook just told Durant, go, let's play quick. Quit playing around.
And Durant able to knock it down. Durant with a long three-pointer. Here's Durant ahead of the field. Goes to the fadeaway and scores. Here comes Curry. He's triple teamed. Continues. He adds off the dribble. Steph Curry off the drive and a foul.
I think the effort was good. We still can play better, for sure. All of our IQ, all of our gamesmanship, I mean, honestly, we just did what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to win at home. A team that's only lost two games in regular season and whatnot, so this is a place where we have experienced a lot of winning, and you know, we're supposed to do, you know, to take care of games like tonight. There's no real sense of accomplishment because of that, because we know what we still have to do going forward.
I mean, I think I was better tonight. Still didn't do all the things I'm capable of doing, but the one thing I can control is the way I go out there and fight and battle. That was my mindset tonight. I was coming to a fight. I'm going to go out there and do that. If all else fails, I'm going to fight. And that'll be my mindset for the rest of the series.
We're going back home, but, you know, we can't relax. We got to keep our foot on the gas. You know, we got to play much better. I thought we played extremely hard tonight. They didn't outplay us. They didn't outwork us. Both teams, you know, were in a slugfest tonight. We got to bring that energy back home. It's a matter of us making a few shots and, you know, playing a little more solid defense on them.
We got to take care of home. Honestly, last night is a different game. We just got to, I guess, play the same way we played the two home games we've had so far tomorrow. That's all we could do. I mean, can't worry about the road. Honestly, can't worry about the road. We might not get a chance to go back on the road if we don't play the right way tomorrow.
Doesn't change. If we want to get a win, my mentality is the same. Come in and get a win, no matter if I'm at home on the road or if it's a close-up game or not. Doesn't change.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
That is exactly what this is. It is the Extravaganza right here on a Friday afternoon, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. We are Toledo sports leader Bob France with you, as always. Since my name is on the show, I better be here most of the time. Jim Cushlin is here as well, and we want you to be a part of it, too, at 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. 1065. Want to shift gears this hour and get away from the NBA for just a bit to talk about some other things that are important. One is much, much, much less important than the other, so let me get it out of the way first. I tweeted about this yesterday with some little bit of outrage, as much as you can generate for something like this, but yesterday baseball announced that Ruget Odor was having his 8-game suspension reduced to 7. After the punch at Jose Bautista, the one that was so celebrated as an MMA-style blow, but Bautista did not go down. And, of course, it all goes back to the bat flip. It all goes back to whether or not Bautista was right to show up the ridiculous Rangers back in the playoffs last year. And, you know, here we come 8 months later, and now they're throwing at him and getting this whole thing started. Jim, I looked over and over and over again. And maybe I'm blind. I have made mistakes before and been unable to find things that other people have found.
Okay.
So maybe you could tell me if I'm wrong. I have looked over and over and over and again for an explanation from baseball as to the reason for the reduction from 8 to 7. In every article I have found on every sports publication and every news publication, all I see is that baseball has reduced the suspension from 8 to 7. The closest I think I got to anything was baseball has considered the cases of Ruget or Rugnetto or whatever the heck his name is, Odor, and Jose Bautista, and reduced his suspension by a game. Okay, we've considered it. And so instead of 8, it's 7. What I have not found anywhere is an explanation, not from Joe Torre, baseball's dean of discipline, not from anybody associated with the league. A press release, a statement that says, here are the extenuating circumstances that we considered, which led us to believe that our original suspension was a little too harsh, not a lot, but a little, enough to give him one less game. This is the reason why. Have you seen anything remotely resembling an explanation? Have you, Jim?
No. No, I really haven't. I'm still trying to figure out. I mean,
eight games,
you reduce it to one. What's the point? I think it's too short of a suspension to begin with.
Well, that's exactly right. There's a twofold issue here.
Right.
One is the suspension is too short to begin with. The second part about it, though, is that how it works now? You give a suspension that is one or two games over what you really want to suspend them, knowing that they will appeal, and then you'll be able to knock one or two off and get them at the number you actually wanted. Because if that's the case, then the NBA is operating, or the NBA, the Major League Baseball, MLB is operating a system of fraud. They're saying that that act was worth an eight-game suspension. They considered it all before they handed it down. They took their sweet time doing it.
Right.
They saw the video. They listened to the arguments. They considered the context. They considered the playoffs last year and whether or not the quote-unquote unwritten code of baseball belongs in this situation. They considered it all and said eight games. Then they listened to the appeals. And again, according to the only reports I can find, Jim, say, well, we have considered, or not even we, because it's sources tell other sources,
right,
that Major League Baseball has considered the Odor suspension and reduced it from one game from eight to seven, and then they drop it. What I want to know is what changed that, because if you don't give us an explanation as to what caused you to say that our original suspension was too harsh, then this whole thing is a fraud. It's a joke. And all you have to do if you're a player, say, I appeal, and then some of it comes off. Not for any reason other than you appealed. Hey, I appeal. He appealed it. Well, if he appealed it, well, then it must be a little too harsh, so let's knock a little bit off. I'm sorry. I am still very, very upset about this. Rougned Odor is a punk of the first order. Rougned Odor doesn't belong in baseball for a long time to come. And if you're only going to suspend him for eight games, then damn it, suspend him for the eight games. And if you're going to say, no, that's too harsh, we're taking one off, you owe us an explanation, MLB. I've looked at every news and sports source I can find, including going right to the MLB site themselves. What is the reason? What is the reason that you took a game back or gave him a game back and said your suspension is only seven? They have nothing. So here's what we know. We know this, that Rougned Odor, when he saw Jose Bautista come sliding, tried to hit him in the face with his throw. He dropped his hand, his arm, his throwing motion down so far when he was making that throw to first base to try to complete the double play. He dropped it down so low that when he actually extended and released it, it was like throwing a ground ball. It was like throwing a ground ball to first base, not a one-hopper. A ground ball, like you're a first baseman throwing infield practice between innings. You throw grounders to your guys. He threw that thing low because he was trying to hit Jose Bautista in the face. That is a punishment worth 10. The attempted assault of Bautista in that way. And all you need to know is the ball bounced not once but twice before it got over to the first base line, which essentially became the right field line, because he threw it so far past down the line first, it was clear he wasn't trying to throw the ball to his first baseman. I don't care how bad you are. Steve Sachs in the late 80s at his worst was never that bad at throwing a ball to first base. And for those who are younger, and that's probably you, Kush, you probably don't know Steve Sachs.
I do.
He was an all-star.
Yep. Dodgers, among others, I thought.
But it was when he went to the Yankees that suddenly he couldn't throw a baseball
right
from second base to first base. it was one of the weirdest things. He had like one of these cases where he was seeing psychologists and psychiatrists.
It was like a non-pitcher version of the Steve Blass syndrome.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. In a strange way, yes. And you know, again, he was a great player, but he just suddenly couldn't throw the ball to first base anymore. It was there was some mental block that impeded him from throwing the ball there. It's just goofy. Anyway, Odor was not trying to throw the ball to first base. Odor was trying to hit him in the face. It is clear. Then, when both guys got up after that, and yes, they're jawing at each other, but who is the first one to strike somebody? Odor, with a hard two-handed shove right in the chest, almost knocking Bautista off his feet. And then after assaulting Bautista with the two-handed shove, the first strike of this little confrontation, then he punches him in the face, the one that made the entire baseball world cheer for days just because of the magnitude of the punch. Finally, a real fight, it's kind of like cheering for the car wreck at Daytona. It's like, I'm not here for the speed. I want to see the crashes in NASCAR. I'm so tired of the little sissy shoving matches that baseball players have. I want to see a fight. Well, here's a real fight. People got a kick out of that. But this guy did three things wrong. Got suspended only 8 games for it. And now they said, we're just kidding, only 7, and will not offer an explanation. So I just have to throw that out there. Baseball is losing respect. At least in my mind, it's losing respect on a regular basis. It's taking games away from people with ridiculous new rules that don't need to exist, including the home plate blocking rule, including the sliding rule at second base, which guys have been breaking up double plays with hard slides forever. I mean, the history of history, taking that away. They're killing something that is or should be thriving. And they're going to continue to monkey around with the rules like this. They're going to continue to create new little sissified versions of the game. People are going to get tired of it. And then when they see something like this happen, instead of standing up against it, they're saying, it's only 7 games. You know, one of their marquee players, Jose Bautista, is not a scrub. Jose Bautista is an all-star. Jose Bautista is quietly having a career that is going to go down among power hitters from his generation with him at or near the top. It's just a goofy thing. And they let it go. I'm sorry. Rougned Odor, in my mind, should absolutely not be playing baseball for a long time to come. And I'm talking not 8 games. I'm talking not 15 games. I'm talking 30 games. If you'd have hit Bautista in the face, we're having a different conversation. If you'd have hit him in the face with that throw, which he was clearly trying to do, now we've got a conversation. He's going to have to find a way somehow to say, no, it was an accident, really. I was just trying to make the relay throw to first. I don't know why my arm dropped down so low and hit him in the face. Something that's never happened before in the history of Major League Baseball. But he tried. And so, to me, baseball has got to fix that. Sorry, it's just there. The second story is obviously a much more serious story. It is a much more dangerous story. Because it's a story that speaks to the importance we place in the culture of the United States on entertainers. Be they actors, movie stars, TV stars, entertainers in terms of music, and clearly and certainly in the sporting world. The value we place on our entertainers, and particularly our athletes, seems to know no bounds. The value we place on our sports, and we want our teams to win, and we want our players to be celebrated, and we want our chance to wear championship shirts. We are almost willing to sell out anything in order to make that happen for our teams. We're almost willing to sell out everything in order to make that happen for our teams. By now you know I'm talking about the Baylor scandal. Everybody is talking about the Baylor scandal. Art Briles has been fired. That's a start. But Art Briles and Ken Starr and anybody else who is found to have been complicit in covering up, sweeping under the rug, influencing law enforcement officers and prosecutors to look the other way. The sexual assault, and in some cases, alleged rape of college girls just to protect their players? Just to protect the heroes that we always give a little bit of extra leeway to? Because this guy's a four-star recruit. He had 9 picks for us last year. We can't send him to prison. All right, we'll take the notes, honey. Sorry, thanks for telling us what you think happened. We'll look into it. A couple of calls to the right people who make a couple of calls to the wrong people who make a couple of calls to the police people, and suddenly the girl's life is ruined. Can't even stay on campus. They've decided to slander her. They've decided to tear her apart, her character, to the point where she can't even stay at school. Covering up some of the most horrific crimes that can be committed to a young person particularly, not that age really matters here, but to a person on a college campus like this, covering them up to protect the program, covering them up to protect players, covering them up to protect coaches, covering them up to protect reputations, covering them up to protect recruiting, covering them up to protect sponsorships, which might go sailing away, which ultimately means covering up to protect money and power, selling the most vulnerable, defenseless people, our young girls in our society, for football. What does that say about this culture? What does that say about us? And that's right, I am going to continue to throw stones at Baylor. I'm going to throw stones at Art Briles. I'm going to throw stones at everybody who was complicit as this horrible story continues to unfold. And rightfully so. Verbal stones, of course. I'm going to continue to hold them accountable. But why am I saying us, then, you're asking? Because do not think for one second that this is the only place this goes on. Do not think that people don't cover up for the misdeeds of professional or college athletes or, again, other celebrity figures that will bring disrespect and cynical eyes at them from the broader community, things that will cost them money and influence and power later. Don't think that these cover-ups aren't happening in many, many other places on many other campuses. Baylor got caught. I promise you they're not the only one. I promise you they won't be the last one to get caught. But there are so many things. What did we see happen at Penn State? Joe Paterno, America's sporting father. I mean, seriously, who was more like a dad than Joe Pa? The glasses, that look, that way of speaking, the mannerisms. If you couldn't trust him with your kids, who could you trust? Nobody. Joe Paterno looked the other way. Joe Paterno looked away from what Jerry Sandusky was doing. Didn't want to hear it. Didn't want to know about the truth. Didn't want to hear from Mike McQuarrie. Why? Do you know what it would do to our program? Do you know what it would do to our reputation? Do you know what it would do to recruiting? Do you know what it would do to Penn State football? Do you know what it would do to me, to my name? All of those things played out at Happy Valley, Penn State. Don't think this is simply a Baylor thing. And I realize that at Penn State it was a different type of crime, a different type of rape, pedophilia, sexual abuse and exploitation of children. And in this case, it's college students who are all over 18. I realize there is a difference, but there's not that difference. Because it's not as much the crime as it is the cover-up that makes it so reprehensible. The crime committed by a sick, perverted, remorseless, sadistic person against another person against their will, that speaks for itself. And we throw people like that in prison all the time. And we don't even blink. It's where you belong. But the person that we look up to, the person that we are supposed to respect, the people that we put in charge of our young people when we send them away to college, for them to cover up the guy that we should be throwing in prison is almost worse than the crime itself, because he enables that crime to happen to another victim. That's why Art Briles is gone now. That's why Ken Starr has been demoted. That's why the criminal investigation is just getting underway to see how many more layers deep it runs. And I promise you right now, within the sound of my voice, there are some people who over the course of the last 48 hours have been thinking to themselves, man, this is really going to hurt Baylor. Their first thought is and was, man, who's going to take over for Art? There might not be that many people within the sound of my voice because we're in Northwest Ohio and that's down in Texas. But you understand the point. All over Baylor, all over that part of the state of Texas, and all over maybe the Big 12 and other places, people were, their first thoughts were what? Not those poor girls. Those sick bastards. The first thought was, dang, who's going to coach Baylor? Man, that opens some space up in the Big 12. Baylor's on the way down. Their first thought was competitive football. How does this impact the team? How long on probation? How many scholarship reductions? Who's the new coach going to be? They thought about football first. I talk sports for a living. I've been talking sports for a living for almost 20 years, starting back in 1997, 1998. I also talk news and politics for a living, and this is one of those rare times that the two blend together. But for nearly 20 years, I've been talking sports. I love sports. It has been a passion of mine since I was a young child. I'm raising a son who loves sports. I'm raising a daughter who really loves sports, for that matter. But I am willing and I feel obligated to say that our obsession with the games, the teams, the players, the coaches, the standings, the fights for championships has gone far beyond what is healthy. When in our obsession for sports, many people's first reaction to the story of sexual assault cases covered up on the campus of Baylor University is, how's that going to affect the Big 12 standings? How's that going to affect the team that was in the hunt for being in the college football playoffs the first 2 years of the national football playoffs? How is that going to impact the rest of the nation? Who's going to be the coach? When we start thinking that first, instead of what you would do if it was your daughter, what would you do? Dad, got a college-age girl? What would you do if she called home in tears and said, Dad, something happened? And you say, first thing you got to do, honey, is go to the police. And she says, I did, Dad. I went to the police. And they said they'd look into it. And then you find out that the police contacted first the coach. Hey, coach. Hey, Art. Got one of your boys here that somebody says did something here. What do you want us to do? Don't write it up. Whatever you do, don't file a report. Get her name. We'll talk to her, and I'll talk to the guys. I'll make sure that we nip this. We'll handle it. Internal discipline. We'll do it. We'll deal with it. You got it, coach. Little girl tells dad, police didn't do anything. No proof, no evidence. I don't know what you would do, but the last damn thing I'd be worried about is who the next coach is going to be. The last thing I'd be worried about is how's this going to impact the football program, because the football program raped my daughter. The last thing that anybody should be worried about is the impact on a sport. The only thing they should be worried about is what manner I'm going to kill that person. And then I will go on trial and do whatever has to be done to me. But the fact that we don't protect our daughters that way, and far too many people think about the impact on our sport, to me is simply reprehensible. There's a lot of other people with a lot of other thoughts on this. I'm going to play some of the clips for you. And if you would like to get in the next 23 minutes that we have left on the program, We'll take your thoughts on that, too. It is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza. Sorry about the heavy nature of this. I've been sitting on it for 2 days since everything broke yesterday. And, yes, we are still interested in the Eastern Conference Finals and everything else that's going on, and the Tigers being in Oakland tonight and the Indians taking on the Orioles tonight and all of that stuff. It's what we love about sports. Kind of takes us away from some of the serious stuff. But you know what? Sometimes you got to stare at the serious stuff. And this is one of those times. Right back with you.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Indeed, we continue on the extravaganza. Yeah, love the new webpage, the new look. We're adding a lot of things to it, so make sure you check out the new webpage, including the podcast, as you just heard in that promo. If you miss a show, you miss an interview, you miss a conversation, whatever it is that you really wanted to hear, or if you just want to see what you missed, you don't even know what it is, it's all there for you. Just go ahead and download it and listen to it on your device, no matter what.
And I do my best to get those up as soon as I physically can after the show is over each day.
And they are always timely, yes, sir, and complete, and thank you so much, Kush. Don't forget to download our app, too, as you heard there. We got a free app for you for your smartphone, no matter what. It's a free mobile phone app, no matter what device you have. Apple, you can find it in the App Store. Google, you can find it in the Google Play Store. Just look for 106.5, The Ticket, or Sports Radio 106.5. Just do a little search there for our calls and our image and download it right there from the app stores. All right. You can also get it right on our webpage, right, Jim? You can download it from there, I believe.
Absolutely. I know there's a link on it somewhere there.
Link to it right there at 106.5theticket.com. I want to play just a little bit for you of Mike Golic this morning on Mike and Mike in the Morning, of course, which we are so proud to bring you each and every day, the best morning sports show in the country, bar none. This is Mike Golic speaking a little bit about not just Art Briles and what he needs to be held to account for. And by the way, I kind of got off track, and I just reminded myself as I teased the Golic audio I want to play for you. I started to say, forget about football with Art Briles losing his job. What I want to know is what the criminal penalty can and shall be for a football coach or just a person who knowingly, because of his power and influence in a particular sphere of, you know, of influence, covers up and attempts to discredit the rape victim or the alleged rape victim. What criminal responsibility is there? Because to me, again, while the rapist, nobody disputes the rapist or the sexual assaulter or abuser deserves prison. We all agree. The question is where does the person who knows that it happened and then covers it up, where does their fault lie? What is their level of culpability? To me, it's almost worse because they are enabling that particular rapist or sexual abuser, assaulter, et cetera, to do it again, to create more victims. It's almost as bad as the person himself. Art Briles, I think, needs to not worry about the fact that his wonderful coaching career is over. He needs to wonder about whether or not his freedom is over. Because if I'm in charge, everybody who had a small or large role in allowing these things to go on, this culture of sexual assault at Baylor University, is paying for it with their freedom being revoked. Forget about their jobs. I'm talking about prison time. That's if I'm in charge of this thing. Clearly, listening to Mike Golic this morning, he kind of agrees. The buck can't stop with Art Briles. It's got to go farther than that. Here's Mike Golic.
I'm stunned anybody has a job. Stunned. I mean, from Ian McCaw, the AD who has just been basically, you know, on probation but reassigned, the president in Ken Starr, you know, remains as a chancellor and teaching at the law school. I'm stunned. You know, there's perception, there's reality, there's what it looks like you're doing, and you read this report or summation of it, and you just think to yourself, how in the hell do you do this? To me, you almost pour ammonia on the whole program. And you just, you know, you just kind of wipe it out and start over again. Now, that's an easy thing to say, but you still have a program to run. So what are realistic outcomes for this? To me, realistic, and I know Art Briles' daughter wrote a post about, you know, you got to wait till everything comes out, the truth is... There will be people that will get caught by the shrapnel in this, and I don't know, I'm not saying Art Briles is one of those, because if you read the report and how he may be complicit in this and in trying to dissuade people, if, was it him, was it other coaches? We don't know that. There's still a lot to read in the report. But you need to, I think for Baylor, you need to say, no, you're gone. And that's where I would have started. With the head coach, with the AD, and with the president, to me, there are a lot more questions to this that we can get into of where we're going to go from here to keep some of the staff, to keep some continuity, and then after this year, quite honestly, get rid of them all and start at the end of the season with a brand new staff. You do it right now, but I'm with most people out there. I'm stunned the AD still has a job. I'm stunned the president is still there.
I am more than just stunned. You know, goalie, and that's fine. I mean, I get his point. It is shocking. It is amazing. Nobody really can understand this. I, too, am stunned, but I am more than just stunned. What I am when it comes to this situation is outraged, angry, not just surprised that people have their jobs, but angry that they have their jobs. And not just angry that they just still have their jobs, angry that they are not headed to prison. Because that, to me, is where this thing needs to go. There are so many people who have thoughts on this. We're privileged to be able to share some of the ESPN thoughts with you, as we are ESPN 106.5, the ticket. And so I want to give you just a little bit here of Scott Van Pelt.
One big thing. We did this segment on Baylor last week. The Cliff's notes were that trouble often accompanies the highest level of success in college football, because it does. I also said it was plausible that a school and the police in a town where college athletics are king could conspire to keep quiet whatever might jeopardize the best run of football the school ever enjoyed. Turns out it was an inside job inside the football offices. Athletic success leads to a more popular university. Baylor welcomed record freshman classes in terms of both size and record number of students from out of state during this run of unrivaled football excellence. Now, when that happens, people get drunk on success and blinded by it as a result. The worst fears of what can happen when a program becomes wildly successful is that it operates above the law, that nobody governs them. A blistering report released by the school's Board of Regents determined that football coaches and athletic administrators at Baylor conducted their own investigations into claims of rape against their players. In some cases, they failed to report the allegations and created a climate that was potentially hostile to the accusers, as well as posing a risk to the campus and the university. In a few words, the investigation found, quote, a fundamental failure, close quote. It's going to cost head football coach Art Briles his job, as it should Ken Starr, who has been demoted as university president. Baylor is justifiably being roasted for this, but they did what often isn't done. They took the difficult look in the mirror. Not surprisingly, they said they were, quote, horrified, close quote, at what they found. So now they're going to try to fix it. Baylor now has the Dave Bliss fiasco on the basketball side and this. What are you willing to give in exchange for your team being better than it's ever been? It cannot be this. It cannot be the entirety of your soul, particularly not at an institution founded on faith.
I got to stop right there. That was the line. That was the line, and that was the question. What you just heard from Scott Van Pelt is what I was taking many, many more minutes to say. What are you willing to surrender for your team to have the best record? What are you willing to surrender for your team to recruit the best players? What are you willing to give up for your team to be in the championship round? What are you willing to sell in order to get that championship trophy, to get that championship T-shirt, to say my school, my alma mater, my favorite team, my favorite player, my favorite coach did this? What are you willing to surrender? That is exactly what the issue is here. It can't be your soul. I said for the first 10 minutes of my monologue on this, I said the problem is we as a culture, we as a society, put far too much emphasis on sports, winning, and all the rest. And I say that as a man who has made his living, fed his family, taking care of all obligations, talking about sports, celebrating competition for nearly 20 years on the radio. I love the games, and I love the championships, and as much as anybody else, I want to one day be able to wear a championship shirt for my hometown city of Cleveland. I want to wear something that says World Series Champions with a picture of Chief Wahoo on it. I want to wear a brown shirt that says Super Bowl Champions, or I want to wear something that says my Cavaliers ended the drought and won the World Championship. But desperately want to see that. But you know what? I don't want to sell anybody or anybody else's daughter down the river when terrible things are happening by my athletes, by my favorite players, and being covered up by my favorite teams in order to make that happen. And that's exactly what too many people don't understand. Scott Van Pelt is right. So is Mike Golic. More heads must roll. I don't necessarily give Baylor the props that they do, that eventually they realized and looked into it and found this and that and the other. Yeah, what choice did they have? When you find out that your coach is indeed circumventing the system, making sure that players aren't held accountable for very serious crimes, we're not talking about holding penalties, and we're not talking about underage drinking. We're talking about serious violent crimes that lead to many, many years in jail for regular people who are not athletes at Division I universities. And when he just did personal inventory of the situation, when he just did internal investigations rather than going right to law enforcement, he essentially said, winning matters more to me than girls being raped or assaulted or abused in any other way. So I just find myself feeling the need to clarify, I suppose, I don't know. I feel like there's an obligation. Look, without trying to sound as completely egotistical as this will sound, because at the end of the day, what I do doesn't matter jack squat to the world. I'm a guy talking on the radio in Toledo, Ohio, and we're talking about games and LeBron James and whether or not he took enough shots in the final 5 minutes. None of this really matters what I say. But I do believe in the power of the microphone. I do believe in the power of the press. And I do believe in the power of, well, the power that should be deployed responsibly. If you have several thousand watts, a microphone and a transmitter, and people are listening to you, sometimes I feel like things need to be said for the betterment of whomever may hear them who hadn't thought about it in that way. So if this bored you, and if you'd rather want to get right back to will DeRozan shut down LeBron, and will LeBron go crazy, and will Kyrie beat up on Lowry, we'll get back to that. And, of course, drive time is coming up. You're going to have all kinds of other fun stuff to talk about sports-wise, but sometimes I think the microphone needs to be used for positive messages. And shining a spotlight on something like this, to me, is that important. All right, that's it. I won't belabor it anymore. That doesn't mean I won't talk more about it as new information becomes available next week when we come back on Tuesday for the extravaganza. Memorial Day Monday, of course, we will not have a live show for you, so we'll have games. But next Tuesday we'll be back, and if there is new news, I will bring it to you, and I will, if I have to soapbox my way through it, I will soapbox my way through it. But that's where we end for today. It is Memorial Day weekend. Please take a time, whether it's 5 seconds or 5 minutes or a long time, to remember why we have the freedom to do the stuff we do in this country, including talk sports, watch NBA basketball, and everything else we're going to do this weekend. Please take just a few moments, say a quick prayer, and thank all of those who sacrificed their lives in service to our country to provide us with that liberty. Memorial Day exists for a reason, and the reason isn't barbecues. Thanks so much for listening. Have yourself a great night. Be well and be safe. Bye-bye.